The book of Genesis, chapter 30, 25 to 31, 21. We must not forget that Jacob is in Haran, beyond the river Euphrates, halfway to Abraham's birthplace in Ur of the Chaldees, the Persian Gulf, that Jacob is in Haran for two reasons. First, he is in flight from his enraged brother, and he is there to find a wife who is not a rank pagan. He now has four women with whom he has had conjugal and indeed begetting relationships, and he has 11 sons. And now the homeland is calling, and there is no doubt that it was the Lord who was putting nostalgic thoughts into his mind, as we see in chapter 31 and verse 3. It was the Lord who was commanding him that it was now time for him to go home. It was natural that Jacob, having seen all his wishes fulfilled in Haran, despite the deceit of Laban, should now be thinking of wending his way homeward, doubtless assuming that his brother's anger would have by now subsided somewhat, and assuming that Jacob's own wealth and prosperity would be some indication, even to unspiritual Esau, that God had forgiven his sin and was still intent on blessing Jacob according to the blessing he had extorted from his father Isaac, but had really been given by God. Here, at least, Jacob was quite open and honest with Laban. And so he presented to his father-in-law an honorable case for his return home. Now, of course, any man who was detached enough from purely selfish considerations would have seen Jacob's point of view and have acknowledged it. And even if he had gone on to make a further plea for him to remain, he would have acknowledged the reasonableness of Jacob's suggestion. But Laban was too selfish to make any such generous remark. Of course, doubtless, the older man was grateful for all that Jacob had done for him, and Laban had seen that the Lord's blessing had been not only on Jacob, but on Laban also, through Jacob's labor and his skill as a flock master. But even so, Laban's plea would doubtless have been that it had not all been one way. After all, it was in Laban's house, and with Laban's two daughters, and as his wives, along with their serving maids, that Jacob had been so wonderfully blessed. Was there not some gratitude due to Laban for that, he might have asked? So he would have suggested there was a certain obligation on Jacob's part not to run away as soon as he had all he wanted. However, Laban doesn't say these things, even if he was thinking them. So acknowledging God's blessing on Jacob, Laban instantly came to the point. Name your wages and I will pay you. And this, of course, really invited Jacob to expand what he had said. which was to the effect that Laban had become a much more prosperous livestock breeder since Jacob came on the scene than he was before. And Laban must know that the Lord had blessed not only Jacob, but Laban himself on that account. But Jacob's argument would have been, wasn't it time that one whom the Lord had blessed so signally as his father-in-law's servant should have the right and the opportunity to strike out for himself and for his considerable household and their advantage? And the avaricious Laban immediately answered, what do you want? What shall I give you? Nothing, said Jacob blandly, and honestly, nothing. But all the time his mind was working furiously, and so out came his proposal. If I remain, I must be allowed to work for myself. I will still supervise the tending of your flocks, but let me select from them the speckled sheep and spotted goats, and let them be my wages. Then, in the fullness of time, it will be plain, says Jacob to Laban, what is mine and what is yours. Now, it has to be admitted that this is one of the most confused and confusing stories, that is, in certain aspects of it, in the Bible. It's not very easy at verses 34 to 36 to know who does what. And the scholars and the commentators, by their divergence of views, are not all that helpful, I must confess. I can scarcely find one who gives a straightforward account of what is taking place, but practically all go into abstruse interpretations on the assumption that what took place is as clear as crystal. Well, it's clearer in the scriptures than it is in the commentaries, I must admit. We see, of course, what Jacob asked for himself for his wages. Sheep and goats of a certain kind. And in a land where practically all sheep are white or whitish, and goats are dark, particolored or speckled or spotted animals are rare. So Jacob asked for those as his hire, and that must have seemed to Laban, you see, an excellent bargain from his point of view, since Jacob's wages then would naturally be very small indeed. So far, so good and clear. But what then? Verse 35. What then did Laban do? He removed all the particolored animals and sent them 3 days' journey away from the rest of the flocks in the care of his own sons. That's important. So that these animals might not affect the breeding of the rest of the flock. And Jacob then continued as flock master to Laban's livestock. That's what I make of verses 35 and 36. And after consulting an embarrassing number of commentaries with various views, I'm sticking to that. The rest of the story concerns Jacob tending Laban's flock. And from time to time this week, reading over and over this story and reading what the scholars have said about it, time and time again I said to myself, if only someone following the scriptures would state plainly what the scriptures say and say that it is plain. But it was a professor of anatomy of an earlier day, a dear man who once spoke at an IVF Christian Union annual meeting in this church, in this box, when I was presiding until Professor Tom Taylor came. He was late for the meeting. It was Professor D.M. Blair, who I say spoke at an annual meeting of the local CU, who wrote about this subject. Leaving aside what he regarded as the superstition about the peeling of the rods, here in this text, he said, we had an ancient example of scientific selective stock breeding. Superstition it may be, but even the International Critical Commentary, notice the word, even the International Critical Commentary, by no means conservative, suggests that there may have been more to the peeled sticks than Professor Blair's idea that it was superstition. He quotes a mixed bag of men. Think of this, especially those of you who know your commentaries. He quotes Driver, great writer on Genesis. He quotes Jerome from the early fathers. And he quotes Wellhausen, the great German scholar who made such a mix-up of the book of Deuteronomy. And this critical commentary says, the physiological law involved in the placing of the rods at the drinking troughs is said to be well established and was acted upon by ancient cattle breeders. And it goes on to list the authorities, which are not few. And then this commentary goes on to say this. It worked this way, that the ewes saw the reflection of the rams on the water at the drinking troughs, blended with the image of the parti-colored rods, and were deceived into thinking they were coupled with parti-colored males. Well, however that may be, the scientific part of this selective stock breeding showed the insight, the skill, not to say the subtlety of Jacob, as also, of course, his cunning in keeping the speckled and spotted products of his breeding policy separate from Laban's animals. But you see, as we noted during the reading, later in justification of Jacob's sharp practice, he told Leah and Rachel that it was in a dream that the principle of selective mating was revealed to him, and that it was the angel of the Lord who advised this stratagem as the divine answer to Laban's craftiness. So there you are. That's what the word says about it. But not only the Lord was watching Laban's wiliness, but his own daughters were also, who naturally were increasingly drawn into sympathy with Jacob. Our father regards us as foreigners, they said. So they said to Jacob, do whatever the Lord has told you. But perhaps we go too fast. It was Laban's sons who, on their father's behalf, first saw what was going on about the stock breeding. They had obviously been party to separating the speckled sheep and spotted goats so that Jacob might not use the white sheep and the black goats for his selective breeding policy. And yet they saw that the number of speckled sheep and spotted goats Jacob possessed grew in number, while the purebred white sheep and black goats decreased. And they were furious, and doubtless told their father. So Jacob noticed that Laban's attitude towards him changed. And at that point, chapter 31 and verse 3, the Lord said to Jacob, now's the time, get up and go with all your possessions of wealth and family. Which Jacob then did. and took flight, bag and baggage, while, of course, Laban was otherwise occupied. Indeed, during Laban's absence, Rachel stole the household gods and took these with her also, and we'll come to that on another occasion. So, crossing the river Euphrates, they sped as fast as such a caravan could travel. They sped towards the hill country of Gilead. What a story. What a drama. Talk about drama. No dramatist, ancient or modern, could quite concoct a story like that, do you think? Indeed, as so often, here the truth is stranger than fiction, because even the most fertile creative minds could not conceive, could they, the arch, crooked, and serpentine things men actually do when their selfish interests are at stake. Take this sophisticated hijacking, for instance. Is the truth of this not stranger than any fiction? But what are we to make of it? One wonders how much more alleged creative writing owes to history than authors realize. A great deal of what is called their creation is really their knowledge and experience of what has happened in the past, regurgitated. But I say, what are we to make of all this? At this stage, not only of Jacob's story, but of the whole Genesis story of the patriarchs, there is contained so many decisive acts of sin. Think of them. The sin of Adam and Eve, of Cain, of Lamech with his two wives, of Noah indeed, and then Abraham and his family, a treacherous lot. So many decisive acts of sin that to disentangle the good from the bad, for God is with them, to disentangle the good from the bad so as to pronounce proper moral strictures is well nigh impossible. And the most we can do, oftentimes, in reading Genesis, is to see where the purposes of God dictate what his servants should do, what Jacob was required to do or was destined to do in his situation, although not necessarily justifying Jacob's methods. And you see, if it were not for the light that the Lord graciously shines upon his word, enabling us to interpret it, we would be hopelessly lost sometimes to understand where the good lay and where the evil and the sin. But the fact that we know that God afforded men and angels at the first free will, and so took the risk of sin and evil entering into his world, rather than the Almighty blotting out the whole creation and starting again. The fact that God at the first afforded men and angels free will and has never taken that free will away and never will, helps us understand. Nothing else will help us to understand, but this will help us to understand and prevent us from impugning the Almighty's complicity in evil and in sin. For we know that if God, in permitting evil and sin, purposes to use these iniquitous things for his holy will, then he must do so sinlessly, so that his pure and holy motives and intentions remain absolutely unimpeachable. And it is greatly to our comfort and our assurance that we know that it is impossible for our God to be coerced into any of the sin and evil which he permits in his world. So that whether we see precisely where the sin and evil are lurking or not, and where the good is, the good which God not only approves, as in Jacob's life, but commands, we know that we can trust the Lord to work out his perfect will without the slightest sullying of his holy name. So that in this vortex of family intrigue and deception, sly craftiness and selfish using of one another for personal gain, which even overturns love of family and ties of blood. In this vortex of intrigue, we can rest content that whoever does wrong, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Esau, Jacob, Laban and his sons, or Leah and Rachel, God will not do wrong. And he will be vindicated, not only so that no wrong can be attributed to him, but also that by his inscrutable wisdom, he will be able to steer himself through the mazes of subterfuge, machination and trickery, with his holy head held high and his heart and mind absolutely pure and blameless. And friends, this is necessary for us to know. Every time people ask us, why does God allow? Why does God allow? And they ask it constantly, and we need to have an answer for them. Here is the answer. It is necessary for us to know this. For otherwise, and short of the knowledge of God's sinless permissions of evil, which so few theological or doctrinal speculators seem to understand, we would be lost in such a fog of contest and competition as would make it impossible for us to extricate ourselves, and we would land in the final conclusion of the book of Judges, that no objective value can attach to what anyone thinks, but everyone simply does that which is right in his own eyes. Judges 21 and 25. All right, but you cannot say that about God, since all the way through history, the holy truth about God's being and nature and character shine through clearly, even while he is not afraid to expose. This is the astonishing thing. Not only are his infinite perfections shining through wonderfully, but he is not afraid to expose as well as deal with righteously and graciously. He's not afraid to expose the most hideous sins in his own chosen saints. Sometimes we are tempted to say, Lord, why do you hold them up to the ridicule of the world? And he does. He says to the world, look at my Israel, what a rotten lot they are. Doesn't he? Astonishing. Flabbergasting. So that you see, for Almighty God's honesty alone, his book should be revered. This is something that the critics of God's infallible and inerrant word do not take sufficiently into account, take note of, or cognizance of. the honesty of God in whatever he reveals, and the even-handedness of his justice to saint and sinner alike. Down here, notice the last two words. The even-handedness of his justice to saint and sinner alike down here. Because that even-handedness cannot be extended to the world and life beyond. Because for those who will be with Christ in heaven forever, his elect, chosen in him from before the foundation of the world, there can be no penalties above, no punishment. For by his grace and by the gift of faith he has given us, he has caused those who trust in him to lean so hard upon his Son's precious redeeming blood that no penalty will ever be possible to mar the prospect of their heavenly glory to come. But down here, as far as the saints are concerned, note this: God is as strict, perhaps stricter, with his saints than with unregenerate sinners. And surely we see that in Genesis before we have read many pages, don't we? And yet, running through history and the appalling menage of man's sinful preoccupations, there is this thread of faith, even in the worst of his saints, this thread of faith, which we have been delighted to call, in speaking of the landmark text of Genesis 3:15, we have been delighted to call the enmity of faith, that enmity of faith that believes God despite the serpent and the devil and everything, which God, as a special gift, implants in the hearts of his own. You have, if you are a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ, the enmity to all evil in faith. You have a faith that is opposed to evil. And if anything is clear in the life of Jacob, it is that although by nature he was a low-down sneak and thief and altogether a treacherous fellow, yet he had what his elder brother did not have. His elder brother, who by nature was very likely, let's admit it, the more lovable of the two, and possibly even the more admirable character in terms of nature, did not have in the slightest degree. Namely, Esau had absolutely no faith in God or any reverential fear of the Almighty, and certainly he had no desire to obey the Lord, however far short of his standards he fell. The difference between the two is that, and it's an almighty difference. There's a gap between Esau and Jacob, of a gap as there is between heaven and hell. Nothing less. I came across in an ancient school primer prepared by one Henry W. Clark, D.D., of last century, an old book that someone had given me. I came across this heading for a chapter on Jacob: the spiritual man with low morality. I thought, dear me, the spiritual man. How do you say that's a contradiction? Oh, no. In one sense it is, but it was a fact. The spiritual man with low morality. What a challenge that may be to us. Spiritual, but with low morality. I thought this was so daring and striking and so seemingly paradoxical and even contradictory. And yet absolutely true to the facts about Jacob. It was true. He was a rotter. And yet he had faith. And of course, the rottenness changed, as we'll see in due course. And so, we must learn this lesson. That it is not where a man is at any particular time that is the most important thing in his life, much as we might be tempted to judge him as he is there and then, and make snap judgments on people, and dismiss them or embrace them. It's not where a man is at any particular time, but where he is going, out or in. Esau, probably the more admirable of the twins by healthy human standards, by the world's standards, was on his way to hell. That's the plain fact. We know that. Whereas this character, Jacob, with the despicable prey which belongs to most of that family line, for they were a treacherous lot, Jacob was on his way not only to heaven, but to becoming one of the most illustrious names in the calendars of religion. For remember, and we'll be coming to this in due course, that at Peniel, face to face with God, that's what the word Peniel means, Pan-El, face of God. At Peniel, he became, as some used to translate the word Israel, he became a prince of God, and is certainly that, although that's not what the word means, but the word means a mighty wrestler with God. And so, if we come to Peniel for a moment, we ask the question, why was Jacob prepared to wrestle so much with God all night? What had happened during those many years in Haran? It was, I believe, because he was determined to get right with God and with his fellows, including his brother, the brother he had wronged. And Jacob then was determined to get right with God and with his fellows at absolutely all costs. Not only to his crippling, but to his death if necessary. Jacob could have died in that struggle that we're going to read of in a week or two. He could have died. And you see, the thing which concerns me most, if I may bring this right up to date, the thing that concerns me most about those for whom I am responsible spiritually before God is whether they are on their way into Him or on their way out from Him. That is more important than the stage at which anyone may presently be. Are we on our way in or out? For you see, it beggars my understanding why, as life advances, anyone, whether in their youth, their middle age, or approaching old age, can think of departing from the living God and from the only source of everlasting peace and hope and joy. Yet, some seem to fall away as they grow older. Now, I'm not speaking about taking things easier when our powers begin to fail. I can begin to understand that, if I may say so. That's natural. But to lose heart and turn away from the God who has sustained us through life up to that point is something which causes me the greatest dismay and sorrow. And I can tell you, often causes me to lie awake at night wondering what more than prayers and all the preaching I have done over these many years I can still do to help people keep bright and shining in their faith to the end of their days toward its glorious end. My house is overflowing with paper I have used in this pulpit, this box as I like to call it, during nearly 43 years, 9 filing cabinets and 46 drawers of it. And as I look over some of these manuscripts, I wonder about my failures to galvanize some into spiritual action. And it grieves me to the depth of my being, and makes me want to go on and on to see transformations and changes in some yet. You see, Esau is one thing, Jacob another, but those who just get stuck are the biggest problem of all. And I wish I knew what more to do about them. What? Just wait and pray lovingly, longingly, sometimes almost angrily, almost always sadly? You tell me. And I'll be glad to be helped with that great burden. Amen. Now the paraphrase. Hymn number 562, 562.